okay. We'll begin. I stopped at a coffee shop and literally on the sign, because I was just getting drowsy, and it's a decaf, what's the point?
Okay. Yeah. That's cute. That's very cute. All right, we'll be, on that note, we will awaken ourselves and arouse ourselves with our learning today. And we'll start with our blessing. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam asher bachar banu mikol hamim v'natan lanu et torato. Baruch atah Adonai notein haTorah. Before we begin, I just want to let you know that at Susan Burse's suggestion, I asked my son if he would be willing to teach one of our classes while he's here, and he was delighted. So I said it wasn't like the pushy mother saying, come teach this. So he is going to do that, and it's going to be on Thursday, July 23rd. It'll be his first Shabbos here when he comes from Israel. So that means we'll only have 2 weeks off, which will be the 30th and of July and the 6th of August, and the rest of the time we'll be meeting. So I'll send out further notice, but now that I know what the summer schedule will be, I'll send it out, figure out how many classes, the cost, and anybody who wants to pay for the summer, there'll be a little discount for it. We're already, it's like the summer, now I feel like summer's almost over. It's almost like the stores are going to get back to school things, like tomorrow or something. So, but for us, it's still summer, so we'll just pretend like it is. Okay, so here we are today, and we are still in June, and today is the 8th of Tammuz. We're in the month of Tammuz, and we are in the Parsha of Chukat, or Chukas, which is on page 839. Thank you to whoever got me water, as well as my Chumash open to the right Parsha. That would be my phone that I don't know how to silence, so we'll just let it go. Just background music. Okay, it's a harp sound, right? Okay. I didn't want it to be alarming to me when it rang. Okay, page 839, Parsha Chukat. So just an overall information to begin with. Chapter 19 follows on the heels of, guess what, chapter 18. That's right after the sin of Korach. The Parsha Chukat comes after that. However, between chapter 19 and chapter 20 is 38 years. Okay, so we get through the preliminary part, and then it's like the cone of silence comes down over the Jewish people for the 38 years in the Midbar, in the desert, and it opens back up again at the end, at the beginning of the 40th year, as they're getting ready to go into the land of Israel. So that's how we're going to finish, because we have Miriam's death is in this parsha, Aaron's death, and the hitting of the rock by Moshe. So all of that is right before they go into the land of Israel. They're just like just on the other side of the Jordan. So we are skipping 38 years. This is partly because the Torah is here to teach us what we need to know for our lives for eternity, and there must not be anything that happened during those 38 years that we need to know about. While it would be interesting to know about it, and we're like, but what happened during those 38 years? What did they do? They learned Torah, they increased their faith in emunah, in God, they built themselves as the great generation that they became. The people died off who were from the sin of the spies, those people died, and then they're getting ready to go into the land of Israel. However, there's still a little bit more, as you can imagine, there's a little bit more drama that picks up, and this parsha also has that. So in this parsha, we also have the people complaining about not having water, but that was a justifiable complaint because when Miriam died, the well ceased, which is why God tells Moshe to speak to the rock, and the water will come forth. And that's when he unfortunately hits the rock and then suffers the consequence, the results, of not being allowed to go into the land of Israel, which is always very tough for us compassionate people to understand. It's like, that's not fair. After all he did, it's not fair. Be that as it may, we're going to talk about a different aspect of that, more focused on Aaron. And then we have the Jewish people complaining about the manna, of it being insubstantial. They're tired of it, and they get bit by fiery serpents. And then we have the antidote to the fiery serpents, which is that God tells Moshe to fashion a serpent on a stick for the people to look at, and the people who look up at it really as a help for them to look up towards Hashem, who is their source of everything, that they will be healed. And the serpent on the stick is made out of copper. Just an interesting sidelight. The word for the serpent is a nachash, just going back to the Garden of Eden. The serpent there, it's the same concept. And the nachash that Moshe makes to put on the stick is made out of nechoshet, which is copper. So the word nechoshet has the word nachash in it. So we have the thing that is the problem and the thing that is the antidote to the problem are basically the same thing, which just comes to tell us that God makes things either work or not work. There's nothing inherently wrong with anything, and there's nothing inherently good with anything. If God says it's good, it's good. If God says it's not good, it's not good. So a nachash, it's a serpent biting you, is not good. A nachash made out of nechoshet to look at is inspiring, and it's the same thing. You'd think it would be a sign of something to stay away from. Susan. Mm-hmm. Very good. Chukat is like, we don't understand. So the chukat, so Susan is leading it into just exactly the right direction where it says, the beginning of the parsha on page 839, the way this parsha gets its name is not from the first sentence, because this first sentence is one of like the common sentence. Common sentences, Vayedaber Adonai el Moshe v'el Aharon l'amor, and God said to Moshe and to Aaron, saying, okay, so that's like appears 500 times. Not exactly 500 times. I don't know how many times it is. It's a lot. Then it starts out, Zot chukat ha-Torah. This is the decree of the Torah. So a chok is a law for which we have no explanation. It is super rational, not irrational. It's the logic of the creator of the universe and not the logic of finite human beings. So the chok, the chukim, are in that category. What's interesting is at some level, all of the laws of Torah are called chukim. They're all basically, we don't really know why we do everything. And we have some explanations that we think we understand, but everything has multiple layers. You think you know the reason for something, and then you find out there's something else. Even think about it in the terms of, like, our food. So we grew up, you know, proteins, carbohydrates, blah, 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 blah. And you eat a variety, et cetera, be healthy. Then we find out, more layers about why certain foods should be eaten and different combinations and things that are helpful. This is digested better with this. Foods that have iron are digested better in the presence of citrus foods, citric acid. Okay, so when vitamins, all that goes together, it works better, it's digested. Then we find out there are micronutrients. Then we find out that the colors in the food also tell us about nutritional properties that the foods have. It's like it goes and goes, and there are all sorts of layers. So when you're five, you think, well, mommy just wants me to have, you know, these four food groups so that make her happy. Okay, and then we think, okay, well, now I find out actually there's a lot more to it. So the same thing is true about the mitzvot. There are layers of understanding, and even if one layer comes to, in our minds, not apply anymore, there are so many other layers that do, that are beyond our comprehension. We just don't fully understand them. So that's the concept of a chok. Now let me pause and ask a question, another chok, another mystery. Is the air conditioning on? You turned it on?
I turned it on, yes.
Thank you. Okay, so hopefully it'll come on at some point. Okay, all right. So the chok, the specific chok that we're talking about in this parsha is called the chok of the red heifer, the para aduma. Now, this is just very interesting. Let's read the verses 1 through 7 just to get an idea of what's happening. And we're going to focus on the very last part, but we want to read about the first part so that we know what's happening here. Okay, let's see. Janice, would you like to read for us?
Yes, starting where?
Verse 1.
Okay. Hashem spoke to Moses and to Aaron, saying, this is the decree of the Torah, which Hashem has commanded, saying, speak to the children of Israel, and they shall take to you a completely red cow, which is without blemish, and upon which a yoke has not come. You shall give it to Eleazar the Kohen. He shall take it to the outside of the camp, and someone shall slaughter it in his presence. Eleazar the Kohen shall take some of its blood with his forefinger and sprinkle some of its blood toward the tent of meeting 7 times. Someone shall burn the cow before his eyes. Its hide and its flesh and its blood with its dung shall he burn.
Don't get grossed out, just continue on. Okay.
The Kohen shall take cedar wood, hyssop, and crimson thread, and he shall throw them into the burning of the cow.
Okay, and then verse 7.
The Kohen shall immerse his clothing and immerse himself in water, and afterwards he may enter the camp. The Kohen shall remain contaminated until evening.
Okay. All right, this is such an interesting thing. So we're going to put the mixture aside, and there's all sorts of wonderful things written and understood about that whole mixture, what's in there, what the hyssop is for, and the crimson, and all of that. This whole rite of the red heifer, the water that is created, the mixture that is created, is used to purify somebody who has come into contact with a dead body. Now, we don't have any problems with dead bodies. We only have an understanding that contact with a dead body creates a spiritual impurity called tuma. That tuma is only a reflection of how much holiness had been present that is no longer present. So if you think, picture like a caricature of a human being, like just the outline of a person, and picture it filled with whatever color you think holiness is. The holiness of a human being, because it has a neshama, is the highest level of holiness that exists other than God. When someone dies and their neshama departs, then the holiness that was in them is no longer there. The space that the neshama occupied, the spiritual space that the neshama occupied, is then filled with what's called tuma, which is like the opposite, the yin and the yang of the holiness factor. So something that has very little holiness only gets a little bit of tuma. Something that has a tremendous amount of holiness gets more tuma. So we don't have a problem with it. However, a person who has come into contact with a dead body absorbs some of that tuma. And they're supposed to, because we have a big mitzvah, is to bury somebody, to attend to the dead. So it's not like, oh, I don't want any of your tuma. It's like you're supposed to metame yourself. That's the verb. You're supposed to become tame in order to do the mitzvah. And it's not like, I don't want to do it. However, once the person has it, then they need to be able to not have it anymore and go back to the side of tahor, to be on the ritually pure side. It's like, how do you affect that change? Big mystery, the waters of the Para Aduma, of this red heifer. But then we have a bizarre thing, which is that the person, the Kohen, who creates this mixture and goes through the whole process with the person who has come into contact with the person who is dead, guess what? Now he becomes Tame. And you're like, wow, is this like a Disney film? Like, it kind of reminds me of, what was it, Cat in the Hat Comes Back, where
the spots
transfer to the bed. I only know this because we've read it at least 1,000 times to our grandchildren on Skype. Okay, and the spots go, and it just keeps transferring from one thing to the next. So then how do you get until you get to your vum or something that cleans up spots? Then how do you get rid of it at the end? So for the Kohen who's involved, the tuma only stays with him for one day, until the evening, and then he immerses, and then it's done. However, that being said, it says that this idea that the Kohen shall remain, it says contaminated, but that's just not a good word, that he is tamei, v'tamei ha-Kohen ad ha'arev, that the Kohen is in the state of tuma until evening, and he will also be in this state on if you go to the next page, it also, this just continues on about describing the what happens and how the person who is creates the who has the tuma, the whole process that they go through. But what I want to focus on, and it was an insight and a commentary from Rabbi Yitzchak, and I just want to say his Vorki. I know that's such a hard word for me to remember, Vorki. Rabbi Yitzchak Vorki, who said that this idea that the Kohen would mitame himself, would become ritually impure, to help another person with his spiritual impurity is an example of v'ahavta l'recha kamocha, of loving your neighbor as yourself. It's one thing to talk nicely, to do something nice for somebody. It's another thing to say something nice to somebody. It's another thing to give of yourself in this way, where you then absorb and take on part of what their, I'll call it a problem, but what their spiritual challenge was. It would be as if you went to a doctor, and doctors were told, you will be given the gift to be able to heal somebody from whatever ails them, but for the rest of the day, you will have some of the symptoms that they had. It won't kill you, but you will have some of the symptoms they had. I wonder how many people would actually go to medical school. It's like, okay, so I help somebody with bronchitis, but then I'm going to have a scratchy throat and be coughing for the rest of the day. It's like, I don't think I want that. Go ahead. Well, you could look at it a lot of different ways. You could say that maybe there is some sort of cosmic something where we absorb from the other person and we carry it. So that's the level. When we talk about self-sacrifice, I gave of myself in order to help another person. So Bethann, you got to hear this yesterday, but we're going to hear the expanded version.
So it does help.
We don't know why, but there's something that helps. But we don't know why. Because clearly there is a change, that the Kohen becomes Tameh, and the person he helped becomes Tahor, becomes clean. So they're clean, and now I'm carrying it, and not you. So that's like, wow, that's really interesting. That's a very interesting concept. Joanna.
So this tuma, does it create like a vacuum? So like when you come into contact with it, like, while it's in that space, like, your holiness can't be in that space?
Yes. So tameh comes from the word to be like a blockage. There is some, it's like as if there's a spiritual blockage, and that's why it has to be released. So
it has to come out for you to, like...
Yes. So it has to be released. The same thing with a woman who's in Nida, yeah, who has had her menstrual period, that the unfertilized egg is called a kiss of death, because it could have been a life that could have been a holy, full person, but even just being the potential life carries some tuma, which is why a woman is in a state and needs to go to the mikvah in order to rebalance and go to the state of tahara, so that her holiness flow, like her chi or whatever, is like chakras, or however you want to understand it, everything is back in shape. Otherwise, it's considered to be a blockage. So the Kohen takes on that by receiving some of that to be involved in this process. Now, whether there is a direct connect the dots link, we have no idea. Be that as it may, in the practical sense, what the Kohen is saying is, I am willing to metame myself in order to help you become tahor. And even if it's just going to be for one day, it's like, that's still giving of yourself and sacrificing yourself. So that idea of self-sacrifice is the expression of true love. That when somebody is loves, it means being able to give of oneself in that way. Valerie.
So the ladies that bathe you when you're dead, and they bathe you, and they pray over you, and they dress you, and all that, they're unclean until...
Oh, no, no. That's a very good question. Excellent question. If the temple stood in Israel, they would need to be sprinkled with this water, the parajma. Now we have a slight problem. No temple. Which means that, and there's no way to affect the transformation. Going in a mikvah won't help it, because this is the only process that helps. Means that everybody who has come into contact with a dead person, and many, many people have, you know, if you're in the same room with someone who's dead, that's called contact as well. Or if you do any of the preparation for the Chevra Kadisha, preparing someone for burial, you are in a ritual state of tuma. However, it doesn't interfere with anything other than your being able to go to the temple and offer sacrifices. Since we don't have a temple to offer sacrifices, it's practically not effective. It doesn't have any impact. Someone can't say, I know why I'm having so many troubles in my life. because I'm in a space, I'm in a state of tumah from having touched a dead body. That is not the case. There are different states of tumah that impact different things. For example, the state of tumah for a woman with a menstrual cycle only affects her intimate relationship with her husband. It doesn't affect anything else. It's for that. So everything has different levels and different layers of connection. However, this is why there are people, and there is a para aduma, there is a red heifer that is alive right now, secreted away in an unknown, unnamed ranch, owned by non-Jews, who is so honored to be able to have the red heifer. They are protecting its life because it cannot have one hair on its head, one hair on its body that is not red. And they want to make sure that there is always a red heifer because, God willing, when the temple is rebuilt, the very first thing we're going to need is the red heifer. We're going to need this recipe here so that everyone can come to Jerusalem and everyone can go up, and everyone who has been in contact with the dead body will need to have this water sprinkled on them.
So what happens until
then? Yes, it's in the United States. I think it's in the United States.
So what happens until then? Let's say I'm one of the ladies that takes care of...
Nothing. You're just A-OK. You're JSOK, but if the temple materializes tonight and you want to go to Yerushalayim and make a sacrifice, you won't be able to go up there.
Didn't only men do sacrifice?
No.
Women do?
Yeah, women too.
Really?
Yeah, so a woman, even after giving childbirth, a woman goes and offers a sacrifice. Yeah, and for other things too, for gratitude, etc. Peggy?
On what other occasions do men go to mikveh?
Men go to the mikveh in these days or when the temple stands?
Both.
Okay, so on men, so for men, they don't have an obligation to go because their tumah they can't get rid of until we have the temple. The only person who halachically can remove tumah related to nida, to ritual impurity from menstruation, are women. So if a man immerses, he cannot say a blessing. So a woman says, Asher kichanu b'mitzvotah v'tzivanu al hatvila. Blessed are you, Lord our God, King of the universe, who has sanctified us with the commandments and commanded us to immerse. A man can't say that. He can immerse 1,000 times. He cannot say a blessing because it's not a commandment for him. It is a, I'd like to do it, to have a sense of elevation. So men do it often Erev Shabbos on Friday during the day, before Yom Kippur, which is also women do it before Yom Kippur, even if they're not menstruating, they're not married, they're not whatever, they're not, you know, in that scenario. And people... I'm sorry, and yes, very good,
oh, yeah.
Before a wedding, there's also that. But that wedding is actually the tumah that comes from being menstruating. The assumption is being that you have not had sexual relations with the person you are marrying, and so you are in a state of nida, of ritual impurity, until you are ready to get married. So the young girls who are going around who are menstruating, they are in a state of nida. There's nothing wrong. It's not like, ooh. It's like they're not eligible for sexual relations at that point. So it's for at that time. And the other time people go is somebody who writes Torah scrolls or who writes tefillin parchment or mezuzahs may also go every day before they write, just to be in the proper place.
If they want.
Yeah, it's a customary.
But none of those, you say, the...
No blessings for anything for the men. Men have no blessings on that. It is a custom for them. So, and if a woman goes for any other reason other than nida, there's no blessing either.
When I converted.
And do you say the blessing, al hatfilah? Okay, so that is because you are affecting a change, because that's part of the halacha of the change.
That's, are you saying the word tevilah like that?
Oh, I'm sorry, thank you. The word is tevilah. Yes. So it's a difference, but thank you, because it sounds like tefillah.
Yes.
You say a tefillah while you have tevilah. Yeah.
It's T-V-I-L-A.
So it's like the word toiveling, like you toivel new dishes that you got at Bed Bath & Beyond that were not made by a Jews. So you toivel those in a mikveh to elevate them, to remove the tumah of being handled by, created by non-Jews, to be elevated for use in a kosher home. I think they just need to be Jewish.
So
if you have a Jewish potter or something who makes you a plate, you're good.
So you take it before Pesach every year?
No. I mean, if you buy new dishes.
Oh,
new dishes. Yeah, you go to Bed Bath & Beyond, you buy something, I think there is a Bed Bath & Beyond somewhere on the East Coast that has a dishes mikvah attached. I'm like, well, that makes sense because it's such a schlep, you know, going from here and there. It's like, just, why don't you just, yeah, have some Jewish person volunteering to, like, dunk your dishes for you. Okay, Eileen, yes.
So I might have missed this, but so in current times, how do you become pure again if you're in contact with a dead person?
You don't.
Ever?
No, you don't.
But
it's not relevant. It's not relevant. It won't affect anything about you because the only level it's affecting is, are you going to Jerusalem up to the Temple Mount to offer a sacrifice, and specifically, especially for Pesach? And if the answer to that is yes, then you have a problem. That's why we have our red heifer standing by for when the temple materializes. Other than that, it has no impact on you. We can't blame it for, like, any of our ills. Like, I know my problem. I'm in a state of tuma. That's my problem. That's not the problem.
That's kind of a weird thought that we're all tuma.
It's a state, but it's not a problem. It's only a problem if you're going to do this thing. If you are operating in this framework and we're in exile and there is no temple, it is 100% irrelevant.
So back in the day, the Kohanim could take the tumah from you, but now it's not.
No, you can't go to your local, you know, John Cohen and say, can you take my tumah? Okay, so we can't do that. It doesn't have any.
Kohen Gadol or Kohen?
No, it was a Kohen. It didn't have to be a Kohen Gadol. It did not have to be the Kohen Gadol. It could be any Kohen.
What's this business of Kohen cannot be in contact?
Right, a Kohen cannot be in contact with a dead body because a Kohen must retain their level of spiritual connection at all times. So they cannot come into contact with the dead body except if it's an immediate relative. And then they are in a state of tumah. So if you are a Kohen and you were in the room with your mother who passed away, that Kohen is in a state of tumah and he would not be able to offer sacrifices if the temple were rebuilt and he was going to Jerusalem to the Temple Mount. So until that time, no. But all Kohanim are supposed to protect themselves. They don't, and they stay away. And that's why if you come to BMH sometimes, if there's a funeral with a casket here, it'll say, attention, Kohanim, there's a casket in the building. So don't come in, because anything that's under one roof is considered you're in the presence of that. So it's only for a Kohen that is an issue.
What if a Kohen's a doctor?
There's different things that's... It's a complicated halachic issue. Yeah. Valerie, and then we're going to go on.
I have a question. On YouTube this morning, there was a picture of a Kohen rabbi in an airplane, and he had put plastic around him so he would not fly over a cemetery. But if he's in the airplane, wouldn't he have been protected anyway?
No.
No?
So I answer that way too quickly. I don't know. And I don't think it was for the... It was for flying over the cemetery.
Yeah.
Okay, so I don't know exactly how that works, but yes, I heard about
like
that.
The airplane would get his level
of yes. No. I don't know. I don't know. I mean, first of all, you could suffocate, so then he'd be in the presence of his own dead body, so I'm not sure what that does to you. Okay, let's go ahead, because we have a lot of other things to talk about. So what we want to talk about is this idea of somebody being willing to take on for the other person, this idea of self-sacrifice. Now, self-sacrifice usually makes us feel like we are giving up something, like, oh, such a self-sacrifice, I gave of myself. But what we often fail to understand is that when we give of ourselves and give a part of ourselves, it works the same way as the sacrifices worked in the temple. And we know that the word sacrifice is not a good word, that the word is korban. That's what a sacrifice is, from the word karov, which means to come close. So that when I give of myself, what I'm doing is I'm actually coming closer to the person to whom I am giving, as well as closer to God. So my self-sacrifice is really a coming close. It's like, oh, I really gave of myself, I extended myself, I became closer to this person through what I gave. And that is the actual expression of love, because that's the goal of love, is to bring close. So we know that the Kohen Gadol and the descendants of Aaron were known. They are known for their loving of the Jewish people. When they bless the Jewish people, when they ascend at the holidays and bless the Jewish people, it's coming from a place of love. That's what their blessing says. Be ahava, that they are doing it in love. And so they are the natural people to be the models of this kind of love to, I will metame myself. I will come to a place of ritual impurity to help you. And that draws me close to you. It draws both of us closer to God. It elevates both of us. And that this is the idea that we're supposed to understand, that we, by extending ourselves to another person and being willing to give in that way, that not only do we extend ourselves, they really extended themselves to whoever, is that I extend my personal boundary as well of the definition of who I am, and I make myself into a greater, bigger, more powerful spiritual person. So it's like, who's the biggest, bless you, who's the biggest beneficiary of the person who's, quote, doing the giving? It's not so much I benefited them. I actually benefited myself the most because I expanded myself. I gave myself a spiritual upgrade. Eileen.
What was that Hebrew word, karov?
Karov.
Means closer?
Close.
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 Okay, now what about this? Like sometimes, like I want to do it and then I offer to do it, but then I feel resentful.
Yes.
And that's no good.
Yeah, no, it isn't. So now, obviously, every situation has to be weighed appropriately. And we have to tease out what's the cause of my resentment. And we have to figure out, and it just depends on the person's level. So I'll give you an example. I read this story when this rabbi talked about this, V'yachta L'recha Kamocha. I think it was him. He gave an example of someone being willing to give that... There had been a kind of a poor yeshiva student. We're going to have a conversation about whether they should be in yeshiva, then we should be working on it. Okay. A poor yeshiva student, and this great rabbi found out that he was not doing well, and so he was giving him money to help support him. Later, at some point, this student found out that this rabbi had positions on certain issues that he didn't agree with and no longer wanted to receive money from him. It's like, I'm not interested in receiving from you. Now, if it were me, I'd be like, fine. Suffer, you know? Okay, that's what it'd be. This rabbi didn't have that approach. He was like, I want to give this person support, and he may not really want to receive it from me, so I'm going to find an indirect way to make sure he gets it. And he continued to support him in a way that this person never even knew, thought that he was dafka not receiving it from this person because he didn't think that this person had whatever opinions that he agreed with. But that did not stop him because he wanted to give, and that was in the face of somebody who was like, I don't want it from you. So now I'm not saying that if somebody does not want to receive from us and we say, like, well, you're going to have it anyway. It's not that. It's like if it's something where it's important that this person has whatever we are able to give and want to give, that we find it's possible to find another way to do it. If a person really can't receive what we have to give, then it's maybe best not to give it, because you have to have, giving and receiving has to have, it is a relationship. But the less that we can have our giving be conditional on one A, B, or C factors, the better, especially since the less we can have it be conditional, our giving, on other people's, their attitude, their, you know, were they appreciative enough, you know, did they do this for me? That's called conditional. The less it can be conditional giving, the better, because our goal is to extend ourselves and become upgraded, greater givers. So not that I don't really care whether you have an attitude about it or not, but at some level, I don't really care if you have an attitude about it. Now, obviously, there are times where giving is destructive, where it is inappropriate, and where it's going to, right, it's too much, the wrong person, the wrong time. Those are all factors that have to be weighed out. But the general idea is, if I have an opportunity to give, and I can, that I should. And that this is for my benefit more than theirs, because I'm the one who grows from that. Every time I give, I extend myself and I become a greater person. So why wouldn't I be looking for every opportunity where it makes sense to do that? We're not talking about random, indiscriminate giving. We're talking about appropriate, necessary, etc. Hetty.
I could see, in that example you gave, that you would do something like that for a kid. Oh, I don't want them to know it's coming from me.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, or if you want to tell them something, you know they're not going to listen to mom, you would say to maybe an aunt,
yes.
You know what? Why don't you tell them that?
And it's not limited to kids. You can. There are adults in our lives where that strategy works equally well, where we're all different. Different people can hear different messages from different people. We're wise. Some people say, oh, that's so manipulative. It's like, no, it's smart. Okay, it's smart to be able to do that. So whether it's in the realm of that, of advice or guidance or giving in any other way of extending ourselves, we're supposed to be looking. The metaphor that came to me, and again, Beth Ann, I apologize for you hearing this again, is, you know, I upgraded my phone in December from a flip phone to an iPhone.
Yay.
And I mean, the people where now I can't remember who has my phone, if it's Sprint or Verizon, whoever it is, they were like, okay. So, you know, you turn in your old phone, and then you get your new phone. So, and you also give them a whole lot of more money. Okay. So I sacrificed my flip phone and gave them money for the privilege of having an iPhone. But I don't walk around with a little sad face saying, oh, I gave up my flip phone, and now I have an iPhone. I'm like, look what I have. I gave up my flip phone, I gave him a whole lot more money, and now look what I have. I have this complete upgraded experience with more connectivity, more possibilities, more potential, with a great camera. It's like, it's an upgrade. Most people, you just say the word upgrade and they're all over it. Like, an upgrade, we always want everything upgraded. Even it's like our shampoo, it's been upgraded. We're looking for that. It's like, okay, it costs a little bit more, but I'm getting more. So that's the idea, is that we are upgrading ourselves every time we give to another person. So why wouldn't I look to do that and pay the money for it? So it says that's the self-sacrifice. And sometimes the sacrifice is of ego, of saying, okay, I'm willing to give, even if you aren't the most, you know, I mean, you have to be careful about deserving. I would say the most appreciative recipient. Because I need to say, did I give for your appreciation or did I give because I wanted to give? We're supposed to look at opportunities to give when we aren't met with the greatest responsiveness as an opportunity to really give for the mitzvah of giving and not for what I'm going to get out of it directly from this other person. So there's, again, you have all these scenarios have to be carefully thought out, but the goal is looking for opportunities to give of myself. And we're not talking about just financially. We're talking about giving of ourselves, of our time, our energy, our talents, our resources, an ear to listen. It could be anything of giving to another person and being willing to have something that we lose, but it's like we lose it like how I lost my flip phone. Okay, I lost it, but I got a big upgrade in exchange. Mindy.
I had heard that the highest level of tzedakah is anonymous, where the receiver does not know you're the one giving.
Okay, so it's close to the highest. The highest is to do something to enable the person to not need the tzedakah. So it's right up there, though. Yes, teach them how to fish rather than giving them fish. That's right, to make them not needy. So that's true with tzedakah. With chesed, acts of kindness, it's not necessarily true. Because chesed, an act of kindness, is designed to create connection between people. So it's hard to be connected to somebody if they don't know I did anything for them. Now, random acts of, you know, chesed are also can be fine. But this is talking about being in a relationship. Like the Kohen was in a very close relationship with the person he was with. And you can imagine you're the person who came in contact with the dead person. You go to the Kohen to have this rite done, and you know that the Kohen now he's got the tumah until evening. You feel like, wow, that was so nice of him to do that for me. So it sounds like the Kohen's not supposed to say, you owe me. But there does create a relationship like, wow, he must really love me if he's willing to do that for me. Because there's no amount of money. It's like, okay, if you pay me $500, then I won't get the tumah. There's like no money. There's no amount you can pay. It's just the process. So it's supposed to be an expression of, I know you love me because I see what you do for me. We see that kids, when they get older, God willing, they reach the age where they're able to say to their parents, wow, you did so much for me. It takes several decades, but it could happen. Joanna?
Yeah, I feel like I'm wondering about sort of in the giving versus the conditions of appreciation or whatever. But it's not always that. You're also giving them by teaching them how to appreciate what they're getting and how to see that, especially when you're giving to children.
Right. Children is a whole different thing, because then we are instructing. Educating. We are educating.
You're also trying.
You're trying to do that. If it's with your friend, you don't say, and now I'd like to give you an opportunity. It's only because I care about your education that I'd like to tell you
that you have to say thank you.
That you need to say thank you. But I'll tell you, yeah, it's not easy. And sometimes it's like, I cannot believe this. I didn't say anything. So anyway, it's challenging. But this whole idea of looking at it from our perspective of, we want to be like the Kohanim. It's like, why do we need to know this if the Kohen was, you know, they was in a state of Tuma until evening? Isn't that just kind of like, you know, some logistical things going on in the temple? We don't know everything.
TMI?
What was that? Yeah, TMI. Yeah, it's like, who cares? You know, we got this going. And we don't know anything else about some of the other details about the sacrifices. We don't hear, like, all the logistical things. So if we need to know this, it's because it's not just the Kohanim who need to know this. We need to know this. And especially, this is where it's picking up, and we're going into, these are the lessons you must know. And so this is what we need to appreciate. Janice, did you have your hand?
Yeah. I did. I just wanted to share something where I was struggling with this about a year ago. And the notion in particular was giving to people on the street.
Mm.
And I had the opportunity to go to Chicago with my husband. He was in a meeting all day. And I was just wandering, you know, the main drags of Chicago, Michigan Avenue, whatever. And I decided to give $1 to anyone who asked. And so I went in, I got a bunch of change, because I wanted to see
what that felt like.
Yeah, what that felt like. And I started out, and, you know, first it was hard. And then, as the day went on, I started giving to people who didn't ask, who were just slumped over, you know, they had just given up hope. With every giving, I felt this joy just grow. It was the most amazing experience, one of the most amazing experiences.
That's so beautiful you had that, and that points to exactly what we're told, that it is better to give small amounts of money to lots of different people than to write one big check, because it is the repeated act of giving that develops the giving muscle in us and connects us to define ourselves as a giver. A person who makes the mega gift
once
in a while and great distance, like, they're not a giver. They gave a gift, but they cannot really call themselves a giver. A person, a little simple person who puts 2 cents into the tzedakah box every day from their meager whatever, that person is a giver because they are developing that, and they connect and they grow from that. And if we want to grow, we have to become givers. And that's the path to spiritual elevation. We cannot think ourselves into a higher spiritual level. We have to act ourselves into a higher spiritual level. That's so beautiful. That's beautiful. And it also, it can be, it's interesting, because it also doesn't have to be money, because some people are hesitant about that. It can be food. People carry, like, granola bars or things like that. But what it means is that you were looking then for opportunities. A person who's looking for opportunities to give is a different kind of person than a person who's looking to not look. Okay? Like, I hope they don't ask me. I don't really see them. And one of the things I've been trying to do, not always successfully, is that if somebody's on the street and my little thing that I usually keep in the car, I don't have and I'm not giving money, is to make eye contact with the person and nod to them and wave to at least say, I see you as a person. I'm not pretending that you don't exist on the corner. So there's lots of ways of giving, but it means opening ourselves up to say, I can give of myself, and I'm extending my boundary to include you as well. And that's what makes us a great person. So that is the goal of this chok, this beautiful chok, which, again, we don't understand. And maybe it's, you know, maybe this is a piece of it. We can only appreciate things, you know, at certain levels. But the metaphysics of love and of giving, that we think we gave up something. I metamed myself. I gave up something for you. But really, I'm the one who grew the most. I gained more, and I became closer to you, and I became closer to Hashem, and that's the only reason we're here anyway. So this is the path to that level of spiritual connection. So, yes, Eileen.
I think it was last week you said something about how giving, like, more comes to us through God Do you remember that?
Yes.
Could you just say what that was?
So that the more giving that we create a we first of all we create like a we first of all we create ourselves as a bigger vessel, and so that we can receive more blessing. Bless you. So it's our ego is if someone says, oh, they're so full of themselves, what does that mean? They're so full of themselves. There's not room for anything else or anybody else. In the process of giving, it's like emptying out the ego, but from a healthy self-esteem place. I always have to add, this is not about doormat time. I am a nothing. This is about emptying ourselves and enlarging ourselves to receive more from Hashem. It opens us up to receive more blessings. And then there's the other dynamic too, which is that God sees like, oh, I've got a giver on my hands. I can give this person more because I know they're going to give. So I want them to have better health, some more money, some peace of mind, not as a reward, but to make their giving easier. Because if we show ourselves that this we are looking to fulfill the mitzvahs, then God wants to remove the obstacles. This doesn't mean that then I get, you know, easy street life. This just means that the obstacles that come up due to different circumstances that sometimes we earn through our lack of paying attention to our mitzvahs will be removed from us. And then we'll only be left with the struggles and challenges that are meant for spiritual growth and not the ones that are just there to get in our way. So there's a difference. It's like a person, if you think of a skier is on a slalom race, okay, the whatever they're called, the posts that are there, that's part of the race. But if there were like little random children, puppies, and rocks and things also on the course, that's not part of the race. That's just trying to keep me, I'm just going to fail. So I don't even get to do the race. This is what we want removed. We want the obstacles removed, but not the challenges of the actual race. And so someone says, I'm doing all these mitzvahs and my life is still challenging. It's like, great, that must mean that the challenges you have are the ones you need in order to grow, and you got rid of the ones that would have just stopped you. So for sure you can overcome this. So this idea of doing the mitzvahs is where we're at to grow. Okay. Eileen, does that answer your question a little bit?
Is the inverse true? Like, you said that if God sees us as givers, God gives us more. But what if someone's really generous and they give, but they live in poverty and they have health problems and they...
Then those things are meant for their spiritual, for their tikkun, their soul's journey. So we don't look at it. So there was Rabbi Ish Gamzu, the one who says, Gamzula Tova, this is also for the good. And that was, oh no, I'm forgetting his name right now, Rav Zushia. He was poor, he was sick, he was all the things that you wouldn't want to be, and he was the happiest person. And he always said, this is also for the good. And rabbi sent somebody to come talk to him to learn about, you know, life's answers. And they came to him, and the person who came to him was like, you know, I was told to come to you to see, like, what the good life is. And I see, like, I hate to say this, if you didn't notice, your house is falling down, you're in total poverty, you're sick, you have nothing. And Rosa was just like, me? I'm like, I'm a totally happy person. So it's not about the circumstances, and whatever those circumstances are meant to help the spiritual growth, but they weren't there as impediments. They were there to help him. And sometimes, you know, wealth is an impediment. That's the test, because we become full of ourselves and we think we're running the world and we're not, and that's the worst thing that could possibly happen to us. So yeah, it's hard. Susan.
Is that the same concept as
Beshert? Good question. Beshert's a little different. Beshert means it's meant to be, and that usually, I mean, it's used in all sorts of circumstances. We have a Beshert person, like your intended person is your Beshert. Like, oh, I met my Beshert, like the person I was intended to meet. There's also things about that we have actually different, like maybe 5, 10 different Besherts, depending on what level we get ourselves to. So someone's like, well, I don't want to change because my Beshert might be like at this level. And so it's like, don't worry. If you grow to a different level, there's a Beshert for you at that level. It's like a very dynamic process. So there's that concept of Beshert. And then we say it's a Beshert, like it happened. It was meant to be that Hashem is running the world and arranges things to happen. And every once in a while, we get a peek and a look into seeing something that just converged. And it's like, wow, that was Beshert. It was so Beshert. It was so meant to be. And you could apply it, but it tends to be more for circumstances or events or meetings, jobs, rather than your whole, you wouldn't say, I've been sick my whole life, it's so beshert. Okay? It may be Gamzula Tova, it's also for the good, and that Hashem has this as my challenge for me to figure out how does one maintain emunah, faith, and cultivate a spiritual relationship in a place of need.
In a place of?
Need. Peggy.
Is it important to know why we give, or is it more important just to give?
You mean why we are choosing to give, or why we're giving to a particular person?
Just giving, I mean, without any forethought.
Ah, okay, so it's ideal to have, as Gabi just said, kavana, of having the intention, because the thought that we put into our actions enhances whatever actions we do. So if somebody, you know, if we were just walking down the street together, and, you know, let's say there was a gold necklace, and you picked it up and said, oh, here, Ellen, have this. First of all, I'd say, thank you, that's so nice. It's like, so Bashar, we were walking together, and you gave that to me, whatever. But if you said, like, I'm going to look for something because I want to give something, and I want to be a giver, waking up in the morning and reminding ourselves that we want to be givers changes our framework so that we're looking for the opportunities. And that's fine. I say, I want to grow. What that also does is it helps us overcome the obstacles to giving that we'll face, which are that person is, however, fill in the blank, that we don't, makes it difficult to give to them. It helps us overcome that because we realize that is it's incidental. It doesn't really have, it's not really part of the equation. It just colors the equation, but it's not part of the equation. The equation I want is when I give, I become a greater person. Therefore, I'm looking for opportunities to give in appropriate, meaningful, everything else way. Having that as an intention is a good thing to do.
I guess what I was thinking, and she brought it up early with the anonymous giving, that some, I can't speak for others, but it seems to me that sometimes giving is for the glory of giving, for yourself, it's egotistical.
That's true, and then you can say, wow, I am such a giver. Okay, so now that person just kind of negated the impact because they drew the wrong conclusions from their giving. It's the same thing when a person, that can be for anything. You can draw the wrong conclusions and, you know, and what's the word? Undermine your spiritual growth with anything. A person who, wins a prize, let's say, or they win an award, they can say, I always knew that I was the most deserving person. That's egotistical. It's like, wow, what a waste. Another person can win an award and say, I'm so honored and humble, and I'm so honored for this, and this award really inspires me to do more, and thank you very much. So they both got the award, and they both maybe deserved it, but their attitudes toward it determine whether this is going to be a step in their spiritual growth or whether they're going down instead of up. There's only two ways to go, either going up or down.
Same. Or stay the same.
No, staying the same is going down. That's
like, moving up.
If you're not going up, you're going down. There is no option of, there is no status quo option unless you are a silk flower. Then you can stay flat. Otherwise, no, not possible. A silk flower. Hetty.
My question then is, how come in our religion, like, everything is named? Building.
Ah, okay, so that's okay, a very good question. Okay, so when, interestingly, when we give tzedakah, like for to a building, we are, we have the opportunity, if we give and our giving will inspire other people to give, then it is considered appropriate to have our names attached to it. Then we become a vehicle for other people's giving. And tzedakah is unique in that you can also give, you can give in the merit. You'll read something. This was given in the merit of a refuah shlema for, you know, my mother. And you think like, well, then that seems conditional. It's like, no, there's an idea that the tzedakah creates merit for the person. It does. Just the giving of the money. As, you know, as somebody who receives tzedakah, the recipient doesn't really care what your intentions were. Okay? They really don't care. I remember when my son was in college and he was registering for a class, and it was a class that the registrar didn't think he met the prerequisite for or whatever. And she says, okay, I'm going to sign this, but I'm not happy about it. And he's like, he didn't say to her, but he's like, I don't really care if you're happy about it or not, as long as I have your signature on the registration. It makes zero difference. So when it comes to tzedakah, our motivations at some level don't matter. At the higher levels, that's why their levels don't matter. And if by lending my name, I create an opportunity or an inspiration for other people to give, because you notice when people go into a building, they'll look to see who are like the supreme donors, the medium donors, the friends of, and I thought about you once category, whatever. And people look to see, and they place themselves where they relate. It's like, oh, these are my friends. These are the people who like I can relate to. Like, how, I should have given to that, or I could give for that. So that kind of thing, when it inspires other people, we're supposed to do that, to have that naming. You know, there's a joke about a Jewish airplane about, and they was having trouble flying. They couldn't get it off the ground. And I was like, what is the problem? And someone said, I think it's all the plaques. Doorway dedicated by the wing, the bathroom. It's like, you know, it couldn't get off the ground. So, but you'll see it. It's considered an honor that we honor people, we honor things by to elevate them in that way. And it is an honor. This is done in memory of someone. So it accrues honor to that person's memory or to those people. So there is that, just kind of like that balancing act. Again, if the person feels haughty about it, it's like, did you see this building is named for me? Then they're going to lose that benefit. If it's going to be like, I'm so grateful that I was able to do this in honor of my dear mother or my dear father, it means so much to me to have an institution that is carrying on the mission or the ideas or the goals of what I feel is important, that's beautiful. That is totally beautiful. Again, what's going on in the head of the giver makes the difference. I'm so sorry, we're going to have to end here. Anybody who is interested, over at the Jewish Experience, we have Rob Gabriel Friedman is doing a Live from Jerusalem class via the webcam, not webcam, the big Mondo board on communication. So over at the Jewish Experience, it's $20 for lunch from Brooklyn Pizza, as well as the class right now. And so I'm actually heading over there, which is why I'm sorry I needed to. From now until 1, I think, until 1 o'clock. All right, everyone, have a wonderful Shabbos. Enjoy that giving. The Jewish people are, we are givers. And just like the Kohanim, we will grow with our giving.